Not long ago, you just didn't talk about sex, politics, or religion. They were private, indelicate, made public only at the risk of good taste. Today, all three are on the American conversational menu, anytime and just about anywhere. Among them, though, one remains supercharged. Sex, and all the subjects associated with it. Sexuality, sensuality and erotica, sexual orientation, sexual abuses, sexually transmitted diseases. At a time when AIDS and a host of sexually transmitted illnesses make tragic inroads the world over, we find ourselves uncomfortable. Fears and prejudices are aroused. Values and moral views are challenged. But there's a traveling theater group based in Minneapolis, Minnesota, that's trying to change all that. Illusion Theater, currently touring the nation with an AIDS-related play called Amazing Grace, tackles the tough one in an effort to help people think, talk, and learn to safeguard their lives against HIV and AIDS. Today on Conversations, Teaching by Illusion. I'm Susan McInnes. My guests are Cordelia Anderson, the director of the Illusion Theater's prevention program, actor Brent Hendon, and Illusion Theater's outreach director, Ken Carlson. Welcome, and thank you for joining
Hello.
Us today.
Thanks. We're happy to be here.
Cordelia, Illusion Theater's work didn't begin with Amazing Grace. My understanding is you began in somewhat of a collaborative effort to try and tackle sexual abuse issues in and through theater. How and why did this begin?
Well, that's right. Illusion actually is a regular artistic organization that has an artistic season and produces new work. I was working in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office with child victims, helping get them ready to go through court, and was there also to develop a child sexual abuse prevention program. I was surprised to find out that I couldn't look at other child sexual abuse prevention programs for a model because there were none in 1977. So I went in and talked to children to find out what they knew, what they thought, what kind of experiences they had. And while we were doing the research to develop a curriculum and prevention program for children, the producing directors of Illusion Theater came and met us because they were interested in doing something more educational for children, using theater, applying theater. They didn't know anything about sexual abuse. I didn't know anything about theater, but we decided to experiment. And the result of that, with the three of us working together to write the show in collaboration with the company, meaning the company would tell their own stories, do improvisations. They would come to some of my sessions with children with me. They received training in sexual abuse from me. And we'd work together. The result of that was Touch, which was a pioneering prevention program that now provides the language to many prevention programs around the country. And that took off in ways that we never anticipated and became something well outside the scope of the prosecuting attorney's office. So at about 1980, the prevention program moved out of the county attorney's office and became part of Illusion Theater, which was very unusual because that meant that the theater was a regular theater and mm-hmm. actually had prevention specialists on staff and essentially became a theater and a social service.
And I'll turn this one to you, Brent. How does that mix work? Does it work well from your perspective?
For a lot of actors, it's good to have a job, and it helps pay the rent and all those good things. But also, the work that we do is more of a social service sometimes. It's rewarding in a lot of ways because we know that the theater we're doing is actually making changes in people. It's having people to question some of their beliefs and some of their morals, and it's better than a regular play. I mean, it's different also because a lot of times in this work, you are called upon to really give a lot of yourself personally, relating some of your personal stories or some of your personal experiences. And it also, the work that we do with talking about sexual abuse sometimes challenges your own attitudes that you have about sexuality and the way that you may treat someone of the same or opposite sex.
That's what I was wondering about all three of you, as well as other members of the cast and the production team. Hasn't this changed your lives?
Changed, yeah. I think it's enriched because it's helped me to mature a lot of ways, especially, expressing myself sexually. Learning more about myself and learning that there is more to sex than just sex, and that was a challenge in itself. And even when I've done some of the sexual abuse work, you talk about dealing with children who have dealt with very, you know, severe things that you never thought a child would be able to live through or to get through, and it, that's in itself is experience. And I don't know, you just learn more compassion for people and understanding of diversity is out there as well.
Ken, I want to draw you in. Mm-hmm. Here at this point, I want everyone to hear everyone's voices in part. Amazing, not Amazing Grace, Illusion Theater has taken its productions to, so I read, 750,000 some odd people.
That's correct, right.
You're the man who moves this show on the road. It seems to me like it must be a major operation. I'm curious at first how you get your story out so people want you to come.
Well, it's a lot of word of mouth combined with marketing strategies that we hope will work. I think that there's nothing better than having the show seen by people. Part of the reason we're here in Fairbanks, Alaska, or really a great part of the reason we're here, is because some of the folks at the Resource Center for Parents and Children saw Amazing Grace performed in Salt Lake City a year ago. I think I'm fairly eloquent on the phone, but no matter what you say and how well you spell it all out, there's nothing that replaces actually being able to see the show. So I think that that's one of the things that I really work hard to accomplish, to give people a chance to see the show and then really capitalize on that. If there is interest generated, I'll certainly visit with people about the problems and the hurdles that need to be cleared to bring a show to Fairbanks or to bring a show to Long Island, New York, or to bring a show to California somewhere. So the other ways that we do try to get the word out is through workshops that Cordelia might do, though they're not actually seeing the performance, they're seeing the director of the program, and she has a lot of good things to say, and I think that that filters back to the theater. And then finally, more broad attempts at getting out the word, mailings to schools, mailings to social service agencies, mailings to people who might have something specific to do with AIDS, programming, AIDS education. Those are the ways.
We're talking today on Conversations with Ken Carlson, the voice you just heard, the outreach director for Illusion Theater. Brent Hendon is an actor with the theater, formerly with Imagination Theater in Chicago. The rumor is he was stolen away by Illusion. And Cordelia Anderson is the director of Illusion Theater's prevention program. These people also have other roles in their life, which we'll mention as we go along. The play that was brought to Fairbanks is Amazing Grace, which is a play about HIV and AIDS. I wonder if first of all, someone can, because probably 1,000 or so people in this community have seen the play, and more or others will be listening here, tell us what it's about.
Amazing Grace is a play. The play itself takes place in a high school with a student who has AIDS. We don't see the student. We know that he's male, but we don't know his racial makeup or how he acquired the disease. We just know that he has AIDS. And it's a series of scenes of how his different friends and teammates, he's on the football team, deal with the fact that he has AIDS. Also in the film is a document, also in the play is a documentary film about a man named Archie Harrison who is living with AIDS. We see Archie talking to people from the theater and to high school groups, just talking about how it is to live with AIDS and how it affects he and his partner. And also in the play is a very personal aspect, which is a journal. It's moderated by three different people. Cordelia moderates. Another moderator is Nancy, and I myself moderate. And we read our journal, which is sort of a personal experience of learning, for me, learning about HIV and AIDS and doing Amazing Grace. And for Cordelia, it's her experience of knowing Archie and Drew personally.
This is quite a blend of media, because you have film, you have live actors, you have journals, and afterwards you have a connection with the audience. It's also a tremendous assault, but in a very gentle way, of all the things that happen around AIDS. Phobias and guilt and grief and I can deal with it at arm's length, but don't bring it any closer. How did this come about? Did one just sit down to write this play? No.
Well, we knew one of the important things was that although people are hearing the facts quite often and in a variety of ways, for a lot of us, those facts just don't sink in. And one of the, that's like many different difficult subjects that we don't think will really affect our lives. We just don't take it personally. So that one of the challenges was to make the work personal, to make connected to people's feelings, to get people to see how it could and probably has or certainly will touch their lives. And in putting it together, we do a lot of research and development. We have an advisory committee. We spend a lot of time piloting the work. We do improvisation. But another factor that was very strong for us in doing this piece was just the fact that we're working with people that had AIDS. Archie was a strong impact on a lot of our lives, watching him and listening to him. And he chose to be very, very public. He and Drew also did a series of interviews on National Public Radio's All Things Considered for over a year. Mm-hmm. And that series reached a lot of people and was very explicit. You don't usually hear something talking about, two men talk about their relationship and what it's like to be gay and what it's like to live with AIDS. And watching him and then being a care partner to him, they also lived with us on and off, was a strong experience that not only I had, but then everybody around me that listened to my stories had. And that certainly had an effect. The decision to film them was made by the director, Michael Robbins, not because we thought we'd use it in the play. We knew at some point we do a lot of mass media and that this would be a good documentary. But as it all evolved, the film was so powerful, and we wanted a person with AIDS in the play, but we knew we couldn't count on somebody's health all the time to be there every time, that the film seemed like a good way to make it personal. And then I was constantly babbling about all my experiences with Archie, and the other producing director, Bonnie Morris, at one point said, you know, you should read your journal, and we should just have that be part of the play. So it was kind of a hit and miss that all came together, and we were a little nervous about how is this going to work, journal, film, and play, and really juggling people around. But we find that for some people the scenes are the strongest, other people the film's the strongest, for other people the journal is the strongest. Whether you've had no experience with this issue or a tremendous amount of experience, there's something.
And it's a musical as well.
That's right.
And I found you sing a grieving song about mm-hmm. your friendship or the character you play, Brent, about your confusion and grief over the fact that he's hospitalized. And I think that was the thing that affected me the most all the way through.
Yeah, well, one thing I don't think it's sort of a grieving song. I think it's a song about acceptance and understanding. It's the turning point in the play for the character that I play where he first learns his friend has AIDS and he's very confused and he doesn't want to believe it. Then he's angry that nothing is being done as far as, you know, research and, you know, money from the government and the medication that he needs is so expensive. And he's still confused with how his friend, you know, even got the disease. And the song basically talks about his acceptance of this is the way things are and I'm very, very sad and I know I'm going to lose you sometime, but while you're here, I'm going to stick here and it's important that we stick together and help each other through this. So it's more of an uplifting thing, even though it's a very sad-sounding song. It's very uplifting.
Both are there. Mm-hmm. There is another song that I can't remember the title at the moment, but it's about the teens and coming of age is... What's the title of it?
Oh, Ain't Necessarily Sex?
Oh, we have two. We have the Rumors kind of theme
the one
that goes
about coming
through the
of
beginning
age.
Of it is just
also
about...
coming
the
of
school
age is
rap.
Getting,
yes.
Getting mighty old.
This coming of age is getting mighty old is... This play is about AIDS. It's also about teens and AIDS. And I couldn't help but feel that kids have to deal with so much today. And that song is an acknowledgement of that, of all the things they have to struggle with. Did you particularly intend to both talk to parents and to kids
yes,
about
this,
that
this
subject?
Play has changed every time we've done it because we update it. But we, from the very beginning, our decision was to have Amazing Grace reach young adults and adults. We have another piece called Alphabet of AIDS for upper elementary school. And we knew that in trying to reach these two audiences with Amazing Grace that we're all learning about this together. And yet there's different issues for teenagers who are either just becoming sexually active or who have not yet become sexually active versus adults. And in working with teenagers, we're well aware that that there's a tremendous amount of pressure and confusion about sexual decision-making anyway. And now HIV is a whole new dimension. You know, for years there's been so many programs trying to deal with unwanted teen pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases that have not been finding very good ways to change the numbers. And now we've got HIV. It's a whole different stake. And yet through all of that, we know that we've got teenagers saying, not me, it won't happen to me. I don't care how many of my friends are drinking, driving, and getting accidents. It won't happen to me. It won't happen to me that I'm having sex and not doing that in safe ways. I won't get pregnant. You know, it won't happen to me is a common way for adolescents to think. So we knew we had to try and get at them on a feeling level and make them try in as many ways as we could to get them to think about how this might touch their lives.
Is that what makes theater, art, so powerful as a teaching tool? Because it does find that feeling level and go right towards it?
I think one of the most effective things about theater is that most of us don't learn by sitting and listening to somebody talk at us. And the visual is very strong, even for different literacy levels, that you may not understand all the words or all the language, especially when you think of AIDS, bodily fluids and high-risk behaviors and all of this medical jargon that makes it safe and nobody understands, including a lot of the people who use it, that when you have the scenes and you can feel the emotions and you get to know the characters and there's humor. So it's a heavy topic, and yet the humor helps us take that in. And then there's all the different feelings, that there's a number of different ways you can relate to it, whether you learn through songs, whether you learn through the emotions, whether you're going to get it more from watching somebody living with this. There's a number of approaches to reach people. And it's real people up there, and there's real people after the show that come out and talk about how this affects each of our lives. And that's role modeling, exactly what we want the audience to do.
You also work with professionals so that if after a play like Touch someone needs to disclose, I've been moved by this and I have to tell you I was also abused, does this happen frequently, and do you have the same kind of assistance around a play about AIDS or a play about racism or a play about any of the other subjects you might cover?
I can start out with that a little bit. In whenever we take a show out, one of the things that we try to require that our sponsors do is prepare some resource lists and have resource people on hand in the event that someone may need to do something as serious as a disclosure or just some general questions that might not be nearly so serious. One of the tricks to that, especially in school systems and community settings, is to convince the sponsor that that's an important thing. I think when you're working with professional agencies that are active in that kind of work, they understand the need for those resource individuals to be available. But I think that in other cases, it's real difficult to convince sponsors to have those people there. It takes 10 minutes to go through point by point, now this is what might happen and this is why that person is really important, and finally a light bulb goes off. But it still doesn't even work. I mean, you can talk to Cordelia or Brent and you'll hear a litany of places where the resource situation maybe wasn't as strong as we would like to have seen it, despite efforts that we make. I know that they've both had to scramble at the last minute to try to make sure that some of those people in the community had been identified and that they knew who they were before the show ever started.
But separate from that, our whole model is based on that we have somebody with that expertise at every single show. And that's a little bit different than, for example, if it was a group of actors but they had some training on the issue. We have somebody who is specifically trained in that issue, either a therapist or a highly trained person that is along with the actors every show. So the actors receive training, but they also know that there's somebody there that if they get into a tight situation with a disclosure or just an emotionally loaded situation or a high conflict situation, that they can bring it over what we call as our moderator. That's really our human service specialist. That's our prevention specialist. And that person's responsibility is to deal with that as best as they can. Ken's whole point is that when we're in a community that's not our own, we need to make sure we're in there and we're out of there, and we need to make sure that that person knows where they can go, whether it's for a test site, whether it's for further reporting, if that's necessary, for further counseling. So we pair those up. We also know from follow-up on various shows that many people don't disclose necessarily right away. Some do. Some are moved immediately. But we also know, and our police departments have informed us, that they can kind of tell where we go because the reports are immediate, and then there may be several weeks after that there'll be another peak, and a few months after, and even a couple of years later where a child will say, I saw this show. Uh-huh. So it comes, sometimes people just think about it, they get a strong awareness at the show, and they wait maybe until something happens again or until there's something else that pushes them, because disclosure is very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. Just like with Amazing Grace, we get students who come up who realize they've done it, and adults, at-risk behaviors, and they never thought about it that much before, or they tried not to think about it, and the show really makes them think, I better get tested.
Sure. There is a character, a teacher in the show, who is assigned to co-teach a segment on AIDS in the classes, who suddenly realizes while he's going through the information that he has done at-risk behaviors. And watching him be appalled, amazed, astounded, shaken as his body and mind kind of take in this information is, I think, would tell a number of people in the audience to stop and think back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've had criticism because we have a teacher that used drugs once in his life, about what kind of a role model is that. And I step back and go, you know, there's plenty of adults that are very, very good people that are indeed wonderful role models that have at times done things in their past that are at-risk sexual behaviors and have experimented with drugs. And our choice about that teacher was very specific because people tend to think only about drug addicts. They don't think about casual users, and casual users have to think about the risks that they have, not just if you're sharing needles, but also if you're abusively using drugs or even using drugs. We don't make as safe decisions. And we also, that character is white, and we did that on purpose because many people think only about drug use in communities of color. And although there's a concern in communities of color, there's every bit as much of a concern in the white community. And we wanted to make that point.
Let me remind listeners, you're listening to Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes, your host. With me today, Ken Carlson, the outreach director for Illusion Theater from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Cordelia Anderson, director of Illusion Theater's prevention program. Brent Hendon, an actor, also a prevention educator with Illusion Theater and a certified AIDS educator. That brings me to my next question. This is a very direct and confrontive piece of work. There is not just a white Anglo-Saxon high school teacher who has used drugs in his past. There is a gay actor or a gay character. There is also a moment where Rico, one of the players who is a football player in high school, comes unglued and screams on the stage, I will not be within 10 feet of a faggot. The faggot, of course, was one of his closest friends 10 minutes before he learned he was a faggot. But this is very direct. It feels like it pushes all our buttons. Reasons behind pushing all our buttons? Mm. Brent?
One of the reasons that we push all the buttons is to challenge those fears. One of the things that keep people at risk for HIV and AIDS is fear and ignorance. One is the fear about it itself. You know, what is the disease? What can it do? And, you know, if I stand next to someone, will I catch it? And also the ignorance that's out there that it's a gay disease, because when it first became very apparent in this country, it was very strongly noticed in the gay community. And it was for a while called the gay disease, you know, a gay cancer. And that seemed to block people believing that they were at risk, especially the heterosexual community. And one of the reasons we deal with the homophobia is one, to show people that homosexuals are real people. They're not, you know, aliens or these sexual machines, which a lot of people believe. They are real people with feelings, and it's a chance for them to see someone that is gay, and then also to realize that they themselves, it's not who you are, it's what you do that puts you at risk. It's not the fact that you're gay that you get AIDS, but it's the fact that you involve yourself in risk behavior that causes you to get HIV or develop AIDS.
When you break through with confrontive lines in the play or personalities in the play, are you asking us to look to ourselves, to examine what we do, who we are, and also what we think of other people who are not us?
A whole goal of the prevention program is to look at individual and social change. And we're well aware that if we want to prevent various social problems, that it is not just a matter of looking at changing people's behavior. But before that, we've got to look at attitudes and belief systems. And if we don't challenge attitudes and belief systems, people's behavior is not going to change. I'm a therapist. I work with convicted offenders. And I know, and studies back up, that one of the primary things that show somebody is going to be act out aggressively in terms of behavior is that the attitudes that person holds. And whether or not HIV and AIDS has touched anybody's life, we know that one of the most common names you can be called in an elementary school is faggot. And the worst thing for a boy to be called is a girl or a faggot. And both of those kind of mix up sexism and homophobia. Mm-hmm. And if we really want to prevent various forms of violence, then we also have to go after people's attitudes about sexism and homophobia, to name a few. And that is very much on purpose part of Amazing Grace. That it's people are going to have different values and different beliefs, and that's fine. But the part of those that we're really trying to change is any attitude that will in any way, shape, or form condone violence against anyone.
Ken, I don't expect you're the only one, but I know in your position you get the fallout from the communities. Let's mm-hmm. use the word feedback.
You can use whichever one you want.
Both positive and negative. How are people responding after, what do we have, 13 years of performances from Illusion Theater?
Well, there are, really lots of different responses. I'll start with Amazing Grace, since that's the show we're touring right now. I think that, and this goes back to something we were talking a little bit about earlier. There are plenty of people in public health and in education and in social service agencies who are really comfortable talking about 2.2 this and 4.4 that, and this percentage and that percentage. But they're less comfortable talking about some of the social and personal concerns that relate to HIV and AIDS that Amazing Grace addresses. So in one broad response that I often hear is, I'm really glad you guys are doing this because I just didn't know how to do it very well myself. And it's really nice. It's complementing what I do in the school. So there are real favorable responses, people calling and saying how much they appreciated seeing it. There are other real strong responses the other side, people feeling that we're being too explicit, that we are advocating openly for homosexuality. And in fact, some people have gone so far as to say that we're trying to convert high school students into homosexual lifestyle. There are people who think that we are undermining good old traditional, red, white, and blue American values. And there are lots of things that come into it. We're dealing with a situation in Minnesota right now where there are some people who are very actively opposed to the fact that Amazing Grace is going to be coming to the county and have made those notions real clear. So it can sometimes be real painful to hear that. It can be real frustrating. But anytime you're going to talk about HIV and AIDS, you need to, at least from our point of view, talk about a lot of different things that we don't necessarily all agree on. So what I keep trying to tell people when those calls come in, especially the ones that are difficult, are that, it's just really almost ridiculous to think that we're all going to be able to agree on every one of the points that we need to address in terms of HIV and AIDS. But we certainly can find some things that are important for all of us to know. And then as we say in the performance, and when I talk about it, it's a catalyst for discussion. And so we want to get people talking about it and talking about it in their homes and in their churches and at the grocery store. And that's where those discussions need to continue.
And even anger and rejection may be a start to that.
At least people are talking about it. And I think that if you get them talking about it, it may be a few weeks or a few months, but somewhere along the line, I think some movement is possible.
Has this been true for your other productions in the past?
Oh, yes.
Each one in its time?
Not all of them have had the controversy around them. I think probably our most controversial one simply didn't get booked that much. That's for adults only, and that looked at adults and challenged adults to look at our own confusion about healthy sexuality and abusive use of sex and violence. We did that in 1983, mm-hmm. and adults said, okay, you can talk to kids, but we don't need any information, basically. And yet when Touch first came out, it was controversial. It was very controversial because on some things that seem ridiculous now. Instead of saying private body parts, those things that are covered up by swimsuits, we said penis, breast, vagina, vulva, and anus, which seems pretty basic, you know, that if you say hands, feet, nose, and toes, there's other parts of the body and there's no reason not to name them. But because we did that, because we talked not only about strangers but people you know and people you may love, indeed people who are relatives, anyone who forces or tricks you into touch or sexual contact, that was controversial then. That all seems very tame now. It's a fact now. We also talked about male victims from the beginning, and that was highly controversial in the feminist community, which I think is a point we aren't only. This isn't something that we've only had conflict in ultra-conservative versus liberal, because in the very politically active groups, in whatever we've dealt with, there's usually some controversy too, like with touch because we talked about male victims. And even though the majority of offenders are male, we do mention female offenders, and that has brought us into conflict with many feminist circles. And I consider myself a strong feminist, so that was very difficult. Just like in Amazing Grace, with some of the very active PWA groups, people living with AIDS, advocate groups, some of the more radical thinking would say that you should never in any way, shape, or form advocate testing. You should never encourage anybody to use AZT because that may be toxic. You know, so that there's various points of view that it's not just a matter of conservative versus liberal where we'll get into controversy.
Can't do anything right, can you?
Well, sometimes it feels like that.
Once again, Cordelia Anderson is with us, Ken Carlson and Brent Hendon, all with Illusion Theater from Minneapolis. Another theme that rolls through Amazing Grace is rumors. Which interests me. Everybody's got a rumor in Amazing Grace, and everybody passes it along. Why?
Well, one question. Of the things when you start doing this is I giggle because I think a lot of that we see in the professional community first, you know, that rumors are a way that things get so out of hand so quickly. And when you take a topic like AIDS, I was just in one of the stores here in town, and somebody said, well, you know, I heard that you just can't believe anything the government says, and I heard that really you can get AIDS all these different kinds of ways, and that they're just not telling us that, you know, they're saying that you can only get it these ways because they don't want us to go into panic about all these different ways we can get it. And that kind of thinking is very common. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one story gets in the press, the story about the woman and her dentist, and then suddenly just about every show we're going to say, we're going to hear, can you get it from going to see your dentist? Rumors spread like crazy, let alone the rumors that are in a high school that can be absolutely devastating to somebody's self-esteem for years after that. Many of us know what that was like when we were called names or mm-hmm. rumor was spread about our sexual behavior or orientation or any of the struggles that are difficult enough, let alone to have rumors flying. So that seems like a common mode of communication that is very damaging, and we in some way wanted to address that.
Make it as direct as possible. Mm-hmm. Give the information.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You have, Illusion Theater has also a series of workshops. You presented one while you were in Fairbanks on social work, not social work, but social work and theater. Something that struck me particularly at the workshop you gave this week was that you gave us a word and told us to mutely act that word out, respond to that word. Some of them were just easy. Kindergarten, be a kindergartner, be a teenager, be an elderly person. And then you started moving us on the hard words. Vulnerable, be vulnerable, fear, and then the word powerful and other than like. What I noticed in that room at that time is not only can a word electrify the intellect and the body, but it can alter the energy in a whole room. As an actor in Illusion Theater, Brent, what do you think about that? I mean, I think the room was moved about 15 times during Monday's exercise.
Yes. Mercy.
Well, I've asked you, I'm sorry, I've changed the subject, which is hard in the first place, but I've also asked you a question out of the blue. But you also do this with Amazing Grace, the power of the word to impact the movement of the play or the power of the word to impact the audience. A word like faggot, which we mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. just charged the audience at your performance of Amazing Grace. When you say to someone, be vulnerable, and that person takes on that task, you change that person. And I'm interested in the power of the word from people who use theater as a teaching device.
Maybe I could start that. Yeah. I think Cordelia. It is one of the things that actors get a lot of training in, to just see when you take on a role how different you may need to be than yourself and how you have to find that part of you. And yet in training, one of the things we want to show people is that there is a tremendous amount of energy that comes around a word and a feeling. You described it actually very well, that if you just put that energy out in the room with negative, hateful, phobic words, what does that feel like versus if you're bringing in some positive energy? And we feel that when we go out and do a show. We sometimes step out and we get in front of the audience, and you can feel the hate, you can feel the fear, you can feel the anger. And each one of us has to learn how to not get hooked by that and to take our energy and try to transform that. If instead what you do is start to get nervous, which I've been in that situation before, like, well, I better not say what I normally say. I remember being in Immaculate Conception Church in Minnesota, and I was raised Catholic, and I've been doing this training for years, and somehow all of a sudden I got nervous about saying condom and penis at the pulpit. There was something. Made me a little nervous looking out at those nuns and priests and standing at the pulpit and thinking about my grandmother. And I know that I've done this enough that centering my energy and my comfort in doing that is going to help to disarm some of that fear and that anger. And yet that's very difficult to keep in mind. Those exercises that you all went through in the training are a way to get people to see the power you can have just by thinking, feeling, and taking on an energy, and how you can transform that. I use that in clinical work. When you think of people who are depressed, when you think about people who get stuck in negative thinking, that's their whole energy system. And you need tools with how to transform that, and you need to be able to just feel that difference and how quickly you can transform your own energy if you want to, and how much power you have to do that.
Because we frequently get locked into thinking and feeling about something in one way because we say about ourselves, I'm sorry, I just don't like that, do that, approve of that. I'm not that kind of person. You get yourself locked into ways of feeling and behaving behind those words. And so teaching people to provide for themselves transitions is very important.
That's right.
In a therapeutic environment. Any additions to that in terms of an actor or the presentation of the play?
Well, one of the important things about doing this work is that, as I said before, it really causes you to investigate a lot of yourself and where you stand on a lot of issues as far as, your attitudes towards people that are different than you, your attitudes towards homosexuality. And a lot of times some of the actors find themselves not agreeing with what exactly we're teaching, but they're able to accept that it is something that is important to put out.
This is not a simple thing to do, is it? To participate in illusion theater.
No, it's not.
We have company come in, and we'll have somebody who's never thought of AIDS before. Mm-hmm. We'll have somebody else that's been through treatment for IV drug use. We'll have other people that are HIV positive. We'll have other people who are gay and very out. We'll have other people that are gay and rather closeted. We'll have people who are married with two kids and live a very conservative life. We'll have other very alternative lifestyles, values, and liberal thinking. And we're all in one company. And then we have different races and cultures. And we've been raised in all different parts of the country. And the beauty of that diversity is we're probably like most of the audiences. We've got people very comfortable with this, very experienced, and people very uncomfortable. We've got people going through major life transformations. The people that have worked with us for a number of the years, all of a sudden many of the people come in and they didn't know anything about sexual abuse and they didn't know anything about this. And your reality changes. Mm-hmm. Suddenly you realize when we do touch and you see all the kids who have already been victims, when you hear all of these stories, your idea of your safe little world has to change. When we ask people after Amazing Grace, how many of you know someone who's HIV positive or living with AIDS who has died, and your community has almost no local statistics, and you see 1/4 to 1/2 of the people raise their hands, your reality that this is not going to touch my life gets challenged.
Yeah, I can speak from a very personal experience that the Amazing Grace has been out for several years, and this is the first time that I've done the tour. And I find myself, after a lot of shows, having just to deal with my own personal fear of what all of this is really about. I mean, even sometimes in the in Touch and No Easy Answers, which are the shows that are about sexual abuse and incest and, you know, personal violence, interpersonal violence, that I have lived sometimes in a very safe little world, and that I do this show and then you see the reactions that it causes, and it still, it scares me, you know, to think, oh my God, that people actually have to live through some of these things that we are portraying. And that's one of the things that drives me to keep doing it, is that it's a good chance for people to see some of the things that other people live through, and that if they find themselves in the situation starting to appear, they can stop it. With HIV and AIDS, you see, and in Amazing Grace, you see what type of attitudes can cause HIV infection. And when you see yourself falling into those patterns that can cause it, you're able to stop it. But then there are lots of people who have already lived through it, and there are more people that are going to live through it. And that's the thing that's very, very frightening, even still for me to see.
In the play Amazing Grace, you not only deal with HIV and AIDS in the community, but you also deal with a young couple, high school students, who are thinking of becoming sexual with each other. Actually, they're feeling about becoming sexual with each other, but they do this wonderful thing. They think it through with each other, which is something I think, when I was in high school, we never thought it through. Certainly didn't talk about it. What an appalling idea. These kids go ahead and do that, and they're very teenager about it. They're balky and bumbly and embarrassed and shy and say the wrong thing and shock each other, but they're doing it. This is also a major message. How did it come about that you decided to not only talk about what we shouldn't be doing and what the dangers are, but what we should be doing?
That comes from our commitment to primary prevention, and that in its very definition means that people need to know not only what we're working against and what the problem is, but what we're working for and what the solution is. And one of my frustrations after 14 years of dealing with abuse is that we have more permission now to talk about sexual abuse and STDs and HIV and unwanted pregnancy. We get more information about all of that than we do what healthy sexuality is. It's okay to talk to teens about just say no and don't do this and don't do this and so on, but nobody's talking about what can you do. And a lot of people are very confused. And the reality is people say, well, if you talk about that, then they're just going to do it. Well, the reality is if you don't talk about it, people are going to do it, and they're not even going to know what they're doing. And that we're so busy trying to get people to not talk about it, and we're so busy trying to get people to say no, and people then get so busy trying to hide their behavior that there's no way to learn how to be safe. So this was very much on purpose, that we try to find a scene that reflects an experience that a lot of us have had, and it just seems that parking in a car and trying to decide what we're going to do about sex is an experience a lot of people have had, perhaps not actually getting through the conversation in the way that they did. But we wanted to role model sexual decision making, role modeling you can say no. And if you say no to sexual intercourse because you're not prepared, in that case they didn't have the condoms, they were not emotionally prepared, they were not ready, that then the reality is you're still going to want to do something with your energy and with your need to express affection. And that makes a lot of people very nervous. But I think if people are honest and they look back at their own histories, most of us did something. We at least kissed, we at least hugged. And indeed, for many people, we've asked kids, what's abstinence mean? And for a lot of people, abstinence means anything but. Even in the 50s, abstinence meant anything but. You know? And so it's really coming back to say, wait a minute, there's a lot of positive things about that. Because as somebody who works with sexuality therapy, a lot of people are in therapy because they get so focused on intercourse that sex isn't fun anymore. They're turned off. It's boring. And so part of this is saying there's a lot of things that are very fun about touching, about being close, about nurturing and pleasuring each other, that are also very safe. They help us release sexual tension. They help us express affection. They help us deal with our need and desire to be touched. And a lot of us think the only way we can get those needs fulfilled is by having sex. And what we find out is we can't get them met that way. So this is a way to begin the discussion, to say sex is a lot more than intercourse, and there's other things we can do that are safe. And let's start talking about what those other things are.
This is a tacky question to ask, and I shouldn't. And if you don't want to answer it, you can ignore me. And it is the $64,000 question. But where do you think in our culture, because I'm asking the three of you to be pundits here, where do you think in our culture that confusion and distress and unwillingness to open the area of sexuality comes from? I mean, we are basically a Puritan culture, and we can jump off of that board, but you, each of you, in one way or the other, therapist, actor, or outreach coordinator, have had experience with American sexuality since 1977. So I put a question mark on the end of that sentence and open it to the three of you. Whomever.
Ben, Cordelia, why don't you do that?
Okay. You're listening to Conversations. We're talking with some of the three major players in illusion theater.
If you look at throughout history, this fear, this sex phobia, erotophobia that we have is nothing new. And also breakthroughs in it are nothing new. And it really takes looking at countries like Denmark and Sweden, where sexuality education is mandatory, where in the ninth grade they all see a film about celebrating your body. They see a film where the kids are being sexual or having sex, and it's not fun. It's not working. So they take a break away from that, and they say, how do you make it be fun? And they teach the kids each, the girl about her body, her clitoris, her vagina, how her body can feel good, how to self-pleasure, how to appreciate her body, how to say yes, how to say no. They teach the boy the same thing. They show them coming together again. They show them making responsible sexual decisions, using birth control and having sex and finding it pleasurable. Now, I say that only as a way to see how far away from that we are in this culture. And they have, the government provides funding to show posters to say, celebrate your body, celebrate your sexuality. There's a picture of a boy nude with an erection jumping into a pool, skinny dipping, and it's saying, respect yourself, respect the other people. It builds on the themes that we are very, very far away from. And we're far away from it for a number of reasons. And certainly organized religion, different interpretations of religion is a strong part of that. And yet some of the best leadership for positive, healthy sexuality is also coming from the faith community. There's a strong split in the faith community about this subject, about how to approach it. Within a certain church, within a certain religion, there's strong differences in the beliefs. Politics have also had a role, which often are connected to religion. There's laws that make a lot of things not okay. Medicine has played a strong role. In 1909, Krafft Ebing, the medical expert of the time, said normal sexual behavior is when a young man falls in love with a young woman. In due time, they get married. In due time, they have sex in the missionary position for procreative purposes. Anything other than that was not normal. Now, how many of us are normal by that standard? So whether you're talking about politics, medicine, religion, a number of different sources have come up. I mean, the whole thing that masturbation makes you crazy and masturbation is not okay not only came from some people's interpretation of Scripture, but also came from the study being done in a mental institution. And they were studying mental patients and found out that some of those people touched themselves. The conclusion, therefore, was that if you masturbate, you will go crazy. And that still carries over into current thinking. So you have to look at studies that were done as well as the different belief systems that have really had a strong effect still on us today. But first and foremost, it's just been something that's private, and there's a lot of wonderful things about sexuality being private. But what people confuse is the fact that sex can be private, sex can be intimate, but that doesn't mean we can't talk about it. You know, I may know everything about what my best and closest friend does, what she likes to eat, what she does, but what do I know about how does she self-pleasure, what does she do in bed? Probably not much. Well, I do. But that's because I talk about this all the time. But very few people do. We don't talk about this with our closest friends, much less in a professional way.
And Illusion Theater is going to take on this issue next.
That's right. People call Amazing Grace a traveling sex show, and I say, no, that's the next one. And then Ken gets very nervous about booking it. Because our next piece will be on healthy sexuality. We consider that the next critical step in primary prevention. I'm very sad by the fact that we used to be afraid to touch because we equated all touch with sex. Now we're afraid to touch because we're equating all touch with sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. I think that if we don't quick deal with some issues of positive sexuality, we are going to lose the ground we've gained in the last 15 years because there's so much confusion.
How are you researching this next play?
Well, we research it certainly by talking to all the professionals, forming an advisory committee, like always, talking to many different ages. But I think the unique thing we've done this time is we've been doing what we call sexual health focus groups. We've talked to fourth and fifth graders, to high school students, to people living with AIDS and HIV, to people who work in that field, to people who work in sexual violence. And the common theme is we come in and we say, you're not talking from that position, but yourself. We are all sexual beings. So let's get out of our head, even though between our ears is our biggest sex organ, and let's talk about how we survived sexually. We all have a lot of pain, shame, guilt. Many of us have abusive experiences, abusive relationships, horrendous body image. But let's talk about how did we get through that? What did we learn? Not all the negative stuff, because we all know about that, but what did we learn that was positive? Who really was a positive influence and why? How did we learn about sexual desire and what do we know about that now? How do we know how to express that? What do you do when you get aroused? Which, by the way, is one of the toughest things for adults to talk to teens about, and that's critical, which is what do you do, you know, how do you get aroused and what do you do when you're aroused?
And it's critical because that leads to either responsible or irresponsible decision making.
Absolutely.
Right?
And if you want to know how to set boundaries, you can't set them if you don't even know what your body does. And get very confused when it gets aroused. So these are groups that people come in and focus just on positive sexuality for themselves. That helps us listen to themes, listen to people's experiences, find out stories that are maybe going to be that story like the car scene that a lot of people can relate to. That gives us different ideas of different parameters. For example, we had one woman raised in Greece, and this isn't typical of the whole Greek culture, but she, her grandmother sat her down when she was five, taught her about self-pleasuring, respecting her body, taught her about the importance of knowing what felt good to her, and when she got to an age and emotional maturity to have sex, the importance to be able to express that to another person about what you like and what you don't like, and that you didn't need another person to make yourself feel good. Most of us sat back and went, okay, that's one end of the continuum. I'm well on the other side. But that was just ways to help us think how different it could be. Like looking at the Swedish or Danish models really just help us see something that's so different from our own, it's almost hard to imagine it.
Will this next play have information in it, theatric information in it, about self-protection as well?
Well, we never know for sure. We start with a list of about 55 things that will be in it. And we wind up getting a lot of them in it. But certainly we'll be dealing with safer sex. We'll be dealing with abusive and exploitive use of sex, and making a bridge to say, those are the realities of the 90s, but also what is healthy. And if you're going to be sexual in this day and age, there's a number of different ways to do it, and in that you need to make sure you're being safe.
Is this play a couple years off?
I think we'll be taking out the first tour in the fall of 1991. It'll be a pilot tour, so The work will be done this winter and probably in the summer and probably in the fall and probably for many falls to come if it follows the same pattern as Amazing Grace. But we'll take out the first run of it probably in the fall of 91 and then likely again either the following spring or certainly the fall of 92 again.
And how is the outreach director anticipating?
Well, the outreach director is anticipating lots of concerns, lots of questions. I think the one thing that I do have a lot of faith in, though, is that Illusion Theater, particularly in Minnesota, but nationally in many places as well, has a following of people who really believe in our ability to deal with these things, deal with them in a sensitive and sensible way, and really trust that we're going to be able to take on this subject just as we have amazing HIV, AIDS, sexual abuse, and do so in a way that's going to be useful to a lot of people. So I think that that's one of the things that I really count on. I hope it's true anyway.
Brent, Illusion Theater, I understand, licenses, if that's the appropriate word, mm-hmm. other theater companies around the states to perform their plays. Mm-hmm. Where, how many, what else is going on elsewhere besides Minneapolis?
Well, I know that I worked with a company in Chicago called Imagination Theater, and what they do is They do Touch and Noisy Answers, which are the two shows that Illusion Theater did in Cordelia and Bonnie and Michael had written in the early 70s and 80s, which talk about sexual abuse and incest. And I'm not really sure on the process that Illusion goes through as far as making sure that a theater is the theater that wants to do it is the proper site. Cordelia could give you more information on that. But what the training that I went through was we saw lots of videos and films that talk to victims about how they survived through their incest and some of the, you know, rape victims who had survived. And we also did in services where we talked about our own attitudes as far as these subjects were concerned. And then we learned techniques because, like Cordelia said earlier, that during some shows, kids can disclose. And we learned techniques to not really receive the information but help them find the information and or talk to the moderator, who is in Chicago. The moderator was a social service, a trained therapist in child sexuality, and help them to feel comfortable enough to talk with them or her.
Do you have the same kind of training for Amazing Grace and for each of your productions? Mm-hmm.
So we have licensed sites all around the country, and we have some of our licensed sites are based in theaters, but a lot of them, the Child Protective Services or the Rape Crisis Center is a licensed site. We might work with college actors. We have another program we call Trust, where it's high school kids trained to perform these, and they perform in elementary schools with, of course, a human service person with them, and that's a very effective model in smaller communities. And what's always true about that, again, is a combination of having actors and a prevention specialist, and that the actors receive training on the issue they're about to perform. It helps them to know more about their characters. It helps them to understand that more, and it helps prepare them for the fact that our second act of every prevention show we do is the discussion. And that's asking a lot of actors. It's not just like performing a musical that everybody knows about and leaving immediately after the show. It's saying you're going to be back on stage and people are going to be asking you questions. You don't have to become an expert in this area. We clearly have a person there to play that, to be that role. But you will be dealing with these issues. You will be getting more expertise and you will be answering questions.
This is not Oklahoma.
Right. That's right.
We're moving towards the end of our hour. Let me just reintroduce our guests and tell a little about them for those who have missed the other introductions. Brent Hendon is an actor, prevention educator, also with Illusion Theater, a certified AIDS educator, and formerly with Imagination Theater in Chicago. Ken Carlson, the outreach director for Illusion Theater, deals with the community fears, does the nuts and bolts, is at the front line of arranging productions.
So exciting.
So exciting. Cordelia Anderson is the director for Illusion Theater's prevention program and a therapist. 15 years, I understand, working with offenders and survivors of abuse. Well, I have a last couple of questions. I expect someone in the audience wants to know how to run away and join the theater. Is Illusion Theater expect it is, a stock company with unchanging personnel, or do you constantly have people?
We started out being with a company that was the same, but now we run very much like other theaters. We audition people for each show, for each tour. Many of the actors that are with us on this tour hopefully will be with us again in other ones, but it changes because we need different people during different shows. And several of these actors that are with us now perform in our artistic season in our main stage theater. And so we audition, and we hold auditions a couple different times a year depending on what we need. And we do have an equity contract, so many of the actors we work with are union actors. They're all professional actors. And in terms of the human service staff and our outreach staff, I also need to mention that other theaters do booking, other theaters do touring, but they can have a pretty standard outreach director who knows how to book and sell an artistic show. That is not what we need in an outreach director at Illusion. We need somebody who basically is a prevention specialist, which is what Ken has learned over the years, because you have to answer all the hard questions and know the issues. So that people that are thinking of doing something like this, there's a number of different ways to do it besides looking at our licensing. But I really encourage them to think about the fact that when you look at the play, if you know a lot about theater, people say, well, that looks easy. But the incredible amount of research behind the shows and the hours and hours that it takes to do the outreach and help prepare the community and what the local people do to book us in is something that a lot of people don't fathom in thinking about a show. I marvel at people say, can you come and do that cute little show? They don't realize the rehearsal time, mm-hmm. the incredible amount of time that it takes to pull something like this together. They just think it looks fun.
Cordelia Anderson, Brent Hendon, Ken Carlson, thank you for a very interesting hour, and best of luck to Illusion in its newest venture. Bring it back.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Susan McGinnis. You've been listening to Conversations. I hope you join me again next week.